Support for this public radio podcast comes from AIG Travel Guard, providing travel insurance designed to help travelers face the unexpected. Learn more at travelguard.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of Al-Banan and his work as a witness to the atrocities in Darfur. Al-Banan was born there. His family still lives in Darfur. In fact, he was studying at college in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, when the first attacks began. Al-Banan had taught himself to speak English by studying books and listening to the radio, so he went to find work as an interpreter. While he was with CARE International and working in the camps for internally displaced people, he heard that villages where some of his own relatives lived had recently been attacked, and he learned later that some members of his family had been killed. Al-Banan says it was difficult for him to see all the death in the burned-out villages he visited, but he became committed to making sure that the story of Darfur was being told. These days, his family is still in Darfur. In fact, his brother is working in one of the more dangerous areas while Al-Banan is here studying in the U.S. I'll talk with him after the news. A young man from Darfur, Sudan, is my guest today. He's here, studying in the U.S., and that's kind of an interesting part of his story, which we'll get to a little later on. I wanted to tell you at the outset that the rest of his family, his mother, father, brothers and sisters, they're all still in his hometown in Darfur, and he's a bit worried about them, should he speak critically of the Sudanese government. So I'll be talking with him using only his first name, Al-Banan. I think when you hear him speak, you'll agree that's a reasonable concession. Al-Banan worked as a translator with the peacekeepers. He was there after the government-backed militia, the Janjaweed, attacked the villages.
The Janjaweed arrived on the ground and started to shoot by the Kalashnikovs everywhere. So they burned the villages. There's a lot of people who were burned alive.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
If you check the morning headlines for news from Darfur, you'll see there's not much good news. Reports from aid workers say two villages in West Darfur were bombed by government planes recently. The UN now has peacekeepers in Darfur, but they've only just started arriving and their presence is doing little to stop the fighting between Darfur rebels and the government militia. The problem that the peacekeepers face is not a new one. For example, this time last year, the peacekeepers wore green berets instead of the UN blue berets. They were with the African Union. 27-year-old Al-Banan was one of their interpreters.
While I was working with African Union, my job is a translator, to translate from English to Arabic, Arabic English. We are been working over 100 incidents happen. That's I was there.
You mean 100 different attacks on villages?
Right. The African Union is peacekeeping only, to keep the peace. Because African Union, they don't have enough support to protect the civilians. You cannot keep the civilians from the attacks of the rebels or from the Janjaweed or from the government of Sudan itself.
I mean, you can't really pick up your weapon and shoot back at the rebels or at the Janjaweed. All you can do is just be there to kind of witness it, right?
Right. It's just a kind of reporting and monitoring what is going on, and then they will send it to the headquarters of the African Union in Al-Fashir located.
What was it like for the African Union peacekeepers? Was it difficult for them to see all this violence and then not to be able to help the people?
It's very difficult for some soldiers I was there, especially the Nigerian soldiers. I remember the incident that is close to my camp. I was working in Muhajiria. We went after 3 hours the incidents happened. We get an old man. He was shot in his neck. And he's mentioned to me to come closer to him so that I can get him ready to die, because I'm the only person I can speak Arabic there with the African Union. So, and he just says to me a little words from the Islam, that's La ilaha illallah, Muhammad Rasulullah is no God, but God, Muhammad is prophet God. And I get him ready and he's dead in front of me. And that's one is also the incident. I can remember it every time.
He asked you to say the death prayer for him.
Yeah, just to get him ready to die.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was dying in front of me. And then the Nigerian soldiers started crying and they started talking to me that it's very sad to see Africa is always like that, and there's a lot of Nigerian troops was because the Nigerian were the protection force commanders, and they told me that Africa is always a problem. We have been in Sierra Leone, we have been in Liberia, we lost our friends, we lost over thousands of soldiers in Sierra Leone, in Liberia, and it's not good to see people are killing each other in Darfur, the genocide, and why the people, they kill this old man. I want to find out what's the main problem of, and then I start talking to them because the soldiers themselves, they don't know what is going on really in Darfur. And then I started to talk to them and let them know what is going on.
It's interesting that this story that you tell to me, Albanan, because we never really think of the peacekeepers as being emotionally disturbed by what they see. But this was difficult for them to see the kind of killing in the villages that they were witnessing.
Right.
And hard for them not to be able to do anything about it.
It's very hard. It's very hard because they don't have a logistic support. They don't have financial support.
They don't even have the orders to do it.
They don't have orders, right. And it's only 8,000 soldiers on the ground.
For all of Darfur.
All of Darfur,
yeah.
Which is not enough
to
protect the civilians. And Darfur is the size of France.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. When Albanan was a young man back in the 80s and the 1990s, he listened to BBC and Voice of America on his radio. He set out to teach himself English. Albanan does not come from a wealthy family. His father sells car parts.
I grew up under a Muslim family in Darfur.
In Niala, right?
In Niala.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then early in 2002, I heard the broadcast news announced there is a genocide is going on in Darfur. And I went back to my hometown, Niala, to find out what is going on. A week later, after I arrived, CARE International announced a job for a translator. So I went to CARE International office, and then I started to interview the people. And the people told me that we have been attacked by like two kind of attacks, aerial bombs from the helicopters and gunships, and then the Janjaweed arrived on the ground.
The Janjaweed are the Arab militia who came on horseback.
Arab militias,
right?
Yeah.
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 And this was in 2002. This was some time ago.
It's in December 2002, that the beginning. I'm talking about the beginning of the genocide, which is the government of Sudan start to arm the Arab militia and to sponsor them.
Albanan says the years that he spent as a translator have taken him to parts of Darfur that he would never have seen. His work has shown him many different facets of his country's culture. And some of it he finds very troubling.
I remember this, an old man, his name is Hassan. He lost his son and his daughter. His daughter, she was raped several times by several people. And when she came back to him before they displaced from their own villages, she came, and after 6 months, he discovered that she's pregnant. According to the Islam or Muslim, it's not allowed for a girl to be pregnant or to do sex before she can marry. And the baby is going to be an illegal baby, and he don't want to keep an illegal baby with him. So he's killed his daughter. And that's the things is still in my mind. I can remember it day and night.
What did he do to her?
Maybe he's killed her by the knife or
he anything. Didn't say.
He didn't say anything. But he talked to me like that, and then he started and keeping down. He cannot talk anymore to me.
So he was broken.
Yeah.
By this.
Yeah.
But still he felt that he had to kill his daughter because she was pregnant by one of the attackers.
He thought that his daughter, she became pregnant before the attack. You understand what I mean?
I do.
And that's why it's a kind of revenge and kill her. Yeah.
What did you think when you heard him tell you that story?
It was so very sad to me, actually. It was shock and broke to me. But since that time, I started to investigate more and to know a lot of things. It is not only the genocide is going on in Darfur,
What did you learn? What did you learn about your own country that you didn't know already once you had a chance to travel around?
I went around all Darfur and I met the different kind of people, the way how the traditionals on the tribes. I learned a lot, actually, because there's a lot of over 100 tribes in Darfur. Each tribe had their own traditions way. They have their own food. They have their own culture. They have their own way how to kind of respect and hospitalities and welcoming people and the different kind of greeting and style.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Albanan worked for a number of years as an interpreter with aid agencies and peacekeepers in Darfur, Sudan. He says the recent arrival of UN peacekeepers is not likely to save many lives as long as the government of Sudan continues, as they've been doing, to hire the Arab militiamen, the Janjaweed.
So they paid them money and they gave them weapons and they started to attack the villages that the Janjaweed think all of them are rebels. Every black person are rebels. So they start attacks, kill, rape, looting, doing everything. And that's the order from the government of Sudan.
These days, the African Union is not there anymore, but the United Nations is.
Yeah, United Nations that's supposed to come to the ground, but I think they see Chinese troops, they want to come to the ground, and the Sudanese, they don't want the Chinese to come on the ground, and Egyptian troops too, they don't want them, they're not welcoming them, because they think that their support...
Well, they'll pick sides. They'll be with the government.
Right,
or they'll
with the
be
government with their, side. Yeah. And you know, Chinese, they have a big investment with the government of Sudan.
In oil. Yeah. So what you're saying is that even though the African Union soldiers are no longer there, even though they're starting to bring in the UN troops, it's no better for the people in Darfur? It's still dangerous for them there?
If the United Nations troop is going to come under Chapter 7 peacekeeping forces...
Allowing them to use their
weapons. Them to use the weapons and everything to protect the civilians, that's going to be a value.
It will make a difference. It will save some lives.
Right.
Albanan is taking a break from his work as an interpreter in the different battlegrounds of Darfur. He's now a college student in Greensboro, North Carolina. He says he's found the move to the U.S. to be a much harder transition than he anticipated. And we'll talk more about what he saw in Darfur and his move to the U.S. in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I sometimes wonder what story we might be telling about Darfur if it weren't for the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq. With so many American soldiers committed to those fights and so many other nations drawn in as allies and critics, it's almost as if the genocide in Darfur has to be a page 2 story. As if those of us in the media and the people we talk to don't have room to keep track of so much conflict. I guess the point I'm making is that the civilians in Darfur are the ones who pay the price for that. My guest today comes from a large family in Darfur. In fact, Albanan has asked that I not use his last name because he's worried there might be some retribution against them for speaking. Albanan says he went through some grisly times working with the African Union peacekeepers. It was his job to go to the villages that had been attacked.
We got to the ground. We found the children on the ground. Men, women on the ground, dead bodies. And approximately like 400 people were killed in one place. and the village were destroyed. So we start looking for somebody to tell us who's attacked. And we met with a man. He was a survivor. And he told us the story that in the morning time, the Antonovs came and dropped the bombs. Yeah. And after that, the Janjaweed arrived on the ground and starting to shoot by the Kalashnikovs everywhere. And they used the RPG too. So they burned the villages. There's a lot of people who were burned alive.
They burned the people alive?
Alive.
By what? By putting them in their houses and burning
the
houses?
Yeah, by put them in the local materials, bamboo and stakes. And they will put the gas or whatever so that they can burn the people. And they tied them on the trees, whatever, and then they will burn them.
This is what the man told you?
Yeah, and that's what I've been saw too. Well, I witnessed it with my own eyes.
You could see that the people were tied to a tree.
Yeah.
And that they had been burned.
Yeah. It was so very terrible.
These are your people, right?
Right.
How easy is it for you to be a translator?
How?
Just to be the middleman. I know that you're good with languages, but at this time, you're supposed to be just doing your job, translating this man's story, translating the African Union questions.
Mm-hmm.
How easy is it to do that when you see this kind of death all around you?
I was thinking about something else while I was translating. I was thinking about what this reporting is going to help my people that's every day I've been killing. Because it seems to me like investigating and writing reports without any results, without no any assistance, without no any help, without no anybody can stop the Arab militias or the government of Sudan to attack the civilians, that doesn't make sense to me. So I started myself to talk to the opposition leaders to tell them about what is going on and what is the activities of African Union. And then we started sharing ideas and informations because it was no help to me. That's
this writing reports was not going
it's
to make
writing
a big
reports
difference.
Or talking to people. What? How? It's the same question. We're going to use it tomorrow in the same incidents or patrol.
You mean who came here? Who killed this man?
Who killed the man? How was the security situation? Do you have enough water? Do you have a food? How is the people they're going to have a food? And this is very far distance from the villages and from the African Union camp's location.
So you're getting angry at this time?
Yes. Where from they're going to bring the water? Where from they're going to bring the food? And you will see from the face, people are hungry. You can recognize who the hungry and who is well-fed, right?
So you started talking to some of the politicians to tell them what was going on, yeah? And
yeah.
Opposition leaders.
Yeah.
You started meeting with some of the rebel groups as well?
I met a lot of them, yeah.
But this is getting involved at this time. Now you're starting to get involved in the conflict, right? Because you're helping one side.
I'm not getting inside involved, or I start my work as a neutral person or a neutral translator.
Yeah, but you're telling me it's pretty hard to be neutral when
yeah,
you see this kind
right.
of killing, right?
So I'm going to defend somebody that he's my brother or he's my relatives or he's from my country. If today my country is fired with other country, I will going to defend my country because I grew up in my country. So how that our government dare to do that one to our people and is the same religions. It's the same religions. So attacking people, burning people alive, rape. I mean, this is a kind of revenge, and even there's no humanity for somebody to do that one. So I was very angry, but I don't have anything in my hand to do that time.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Did you think about becoming a soldier, just getting a gun, fighting back?
There's a lot of people that spoke to me, the SPLM, the NRF, they contact me.
These are the rebel groups, right?
Yeah, rebels groups, so to join them. And I told them that we have to start political, because war, it's very hard to get a result after the war, or it's very hard to, because we will not going to be in danger. Our people will be in danger. So civilians, I'm talking about civilians, yeah. And they're talking about removing the government of Sudan. But I'm talking about the civilians.
Because that's who you see.
So it's different, right?
Yeah.
So that's why I disagreed with them. That's to join the SPLM. I'm not telling them that's in their face, but in my heart, and I decided not to join them. Because if I want to solve the problems, the only way is to talk to the people, international community or ICC, International Criminal Court, to let them know about the perpetrators who did, who behind did the genocide of Darfur, to send them to International Criminal Court, to put them into jail. So that's what I've been thinking of.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Al-Banan is a Darfur native. All the time he was traveling through Darfur, working as an interpreter with the African Union peacekeepers, he was talking to the rebels, but he also had to keep track of his own family's safety.
When I go outside the town, I usually call them with a satellite phone.
Just to check.
Just to check. How are you doing? Good. And they tell me they're good, and then I will be okay.
Were they ever in any danger, Al-Banan?
No. But my mom's village been attacked by the Janjaweed too.
Are there people in that village who were killed who are then family of yours?
Yeah, my relatives, yeah. I have my cousin were killed, and my aunt too, she was killed there in the same village, Manawashe.
How long ago was this?
It's in 2005.
It must be very, very hard on your mother, on you, on your family.
It's very hard. It's very hard. Yeah.
You talked to me earlier about trying to think of a way to make a difference, not to pick up a gun, but to get the international community more involved.
Yeah.
You're now studying North Carolina. Your right. trip to the United States, your decision to come here, is that a part of that?
Oh, actually, since very long time, I tried to come to the United States.
Since before the war?
When I was in 17.
You've been trying for 10 years to get here.
But it's very good to get my education and to get my degree.
Do you think the work that you do here, the studying that you do in the U.S., though, will give you the kind of skills, give you the kind of tools to help the people in Darfur?
Yeah. It will give me a lot. With my degree, I can get a position with the United Nations, first of all. That's what I'm thinking of. Through my position, I can talk to United Nations or to the General Secretary or whatever, and I will tell him about my people. That's what I'm thinking of. So we'll see.
Who knows? God knows. I wish you luck with that.
Sure.
I want to ask you a little bit about studying in the United States. I can't imagine what it's like for you to have grown up in Sudan and then I know you worked a long, long time and you went to many embassies and you had a lot of help from people to get here. What's that like to go halfway around the world and boom, all of a sudden find yourself in a foreign country, in a foreign classroom, operating in a different language? How difficult was that for you, Al-Banan?
Honestly, it's a kind of shock to me because the kind of our villages.
You've come from a place where there are dead bodies on the ground.
Yeah, so yeah. It's not the development itself or the technologies. I knew these technologies before. I watched it in the movies and I know the American societies and the American communities over there. But when I came here, I was thinking a lot about who's going to protect our people or my family especially. Because you cannot guarantee that you are going to be alive for tomorrow. So that's why I'm thinking of, imagine somebody is like this and just came to United States and he's studying the college. After 6 years, I left it and I've been working. So and again, I came as a student with the books and with exercise, with the papers, dealing with the class, go. And my mind was busy with a lot of things. I have a lot of things.
You have your head full of Darfur, not your
head
full
of... A lot of things, right, to thinking of.
So it's hard for you to concentrate on your books?
Yeah, it's very hard. And even I cannot concentrate, like the person who talked to me, I will not be attention what he's saying. Just I will let him go, and then I'm going to thinking about, oh, what am I going to do?
You're thinking about Darfur.
Yeah, okay. About my people.
You're in a student dorm?
Yeah.
So you're with a bunch of students who are a lot younger than you. You're 27 now, right?
Right.
So they're like 10 years younger than you, some of these guys.
Yeah.
Guys and girls.
It's a big difference.
Do they ask you questions about Darfur?
It's only one student.
Just one student?
It's only one. He started talking to me about my family, and he heard the genocide is going on and what is going on right now on the ground, and how the family, are they safe? And I tell him they're safe and okay, and just he came to me as a friend. And
are you surprised, Abanan, that other students haven't asked you the same questions?
I'm not surprised, because it's pretty much different. That's what I'm thinking. A student here in the United States, they cannot think by the way I'm thinking.
Oh, they can't even imagine what
And they cannot even imagine the difficulties.
Okay, but that's all the more reason why I would think that they would ask you questions. Tell me about this. I want to learn about it.
Because they don't know even what kind of difficulties. Because people here, they're living in a good accommodation, good life.
You think so?
Yeah, so they don't have any problems. Just nobody has any experience, nobody has problems. That's what I've been so.
So what you're saying is that they just don't even know what to ask.
Because they don't know. Yeah. They're just looking at somebody who is strange at the dorm, with no American accent, with very strange everything, walking, whatever. So they can realize me that I'm from Africa. But
but what you're saying, though, is it's hard to make friends, I guess.
It's very hard.
What about what's new to you as a student here? The campus that you're in, it's a co-ed campus. Do you take classes with women?
Yeah.
Is that something that would happen in Darfur or not?
No.
So is that difficult for you?
It's difficult, but I have to adapt myself, because that's the only way for me to get my degree. Yeah, that's what I realized recently.
Do you think you can explain to me how it's different or why it's different? I'm asking you the question because most people in this country grow up with boys and girls side by side in all their classes.
Right.
Playing sports together. This is new to you. And I'm wondering if you can explain to me why it's difficult for you.
We are grow up in Darfur, separate community from the men and women. We'll not be together. And we don't have deeply relationship with the women, or to stay in one place, to play together and whatever. So I don't have the way to deal with women, like as playing together or doing things together. Everything we do it with the men, so it's not with women. So it will be a little bit different to me. It's no problem. I can talk to the women, no problems. I can sit down in the class with the women, because I've been working with organizations, and there is a lot of international
staff. Some
of
your bosses are women, right?
So women. Yeah. So I'm starting to adapt myself to deal with them, and I can do that one. Mm. But it still will be something inside of me, because I cannot get it out today and tomorrow. So
these things change slowly.
It will be changed slowly, gradually.
I mean, if you go to something like a phys ed class or a basketball game when women are playing basketball, is this just an uncomfortable place for you to be?
That's a good question. I can feel like it's not the place that I'm supposed to be in, and I want to leave the place. It's not something that I brought it from somewhere else, but something inside of me. And I'm a human being, right? So when I have my immoralities, so that's why I must obey it. And then I will see problem. I can come Americanized. I can be Americanized. And then I will see what's going on.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Al-Banan is a native of Darfur, Sudan. He worked as an interpreter for aid agencies and peacekeepers there before he moved to the U.S. to study. He says he's not worried that he will lose his own culture while he's here.
I'm thinking when I get my education, to get back and to help the people and to let them know about what I've been studying here in the United States, and then to let them know the differences of the worlds and what we have been cheated and what we have been came through a long, long, long time.
And while you're here in North Carolina, can you talk to your family in Niala, in Darfur?
Yeah.
How are they doing?
They're okay. They're doing good.
And when they talk to you, do they say, oh, Albanan, you sound different. You're getting an American accent.
Oh, no. I'm used to speak to them. That is by my local language or Arabic.
Yeah, I know. Do they think something's changed at all? Do they hear you changing at all?
No, not at all.
And you, do you see yourself changing?
Oh, not yet. There's no change. I'm still the same person. There's no change in my tone.
And will you change?
I hope.
When you sit by yourself in your room, in your dorm, and you think about Darfur, are you thinking, my people are going to make it, it's going to be okay? Or are you worried that maybe by the time you're finished with your education, by the time you're ready to stand up,
that and then I can get everything destroyed, right? That's what the question is always in my mind, and I can think about it always. Thinking about what's going to happen if I get my graduate here, and then something else has happened there. So it will be kind of shock, because I want to get my degree for my people. So how am I going to get back and get my people's removal already? So that's what I'm thinking of always.
It's hard.
It's very hard. Yeah.
Thanks a lot for coming to the studio.
Thank you.
Albanan is from Darfur. He's studying at college in Greensboro, North Carolina. I don't know about you, but I always learn so much by listening to people like Albanan, who bring an open, new and different perspective to the world and to the way we live. If you have a story or an idea of a story or a person we can talk to that will continue that thread of storytelling, get in touch with me at our website. You can find me at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Let's be honest. If I was to ask around and see what most people were hoping to do with their New Year's resolution, I'd end up talking to a lot of people who are trying to lose weight, stay trim, get fit. So when I read a magazine story about Chuck Hackett, I thought I had to call him. Chuck is a futures trader. I reached him on the phone at his office in Elderwood, California. Chuck told me that he had injured his knee playing soccer when he was about 20, and up to that time he'd never really had to worry about his weight. But then he got a job, and he became a more sedate grown-up.
And after I got serious about working and everything and, you know, took on the load of stress that a lot of us take on, I just slowly but surely started, you know, not having the bottom line of my calorie accounting add up, and it was showing up going straight to waste.
So you started out with a fighting weight of about what then?
I think I was around 180, 190, you know, when I sat down in my chair.
And when did the alarm bells go off then?
The alarm bells went off the first time I crossed over 200, and then I was able to rationalize that, thinking I just looked prosperous. But then when it kept climbing up and, you know, I had other stresses, and I think I peaked at 285. By that time, a whole constellation of symptoms that I just couldn't sweep under the rug anymore had begun to appear. You know, problems sleeping and just totally lethargic. And if you don't get good sleep, it can affect your mood, and that can make you depressed. And if you're stressed and depressed and you have a response that leads you to eat a lot of food to try to push that down, any insecurities, you know, you can try to feed as if there was a famine and you want to prepare for the no food, then you're going to load up on food, and you're not going to sleep as well because your stomach is going to be trying to work, and then you get fat, and it swells up your neck with fat, and it closes off some of your airways. You can get apnea, and the apnea can, in turn, make you eat even more so that you get fatter, and then you sleep even worse. And you just need to have that REM sleep, and it cuts down on your REM sleep, and then you just start making horrible decisions, or, you know, you just see that your world starts shrinking around you. I thought, well, I've got to escape this somehow.
You found all this happening to you.
Yes.
And did you notice yourself being less sharp as a commodities broker?
Well, it's hard to tell because, you know, it's a very subjective experience, but I was worried that was going to happen, and I think it was happening, but even now I would be afraid to admit that it was really happening.
And what about your personal life? Do you find that weight had an effect there as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, once that feedback loop had been going on for a while between the bad sleep and the eating, all I could do basically was come to work and then go home and go to bed and then come to work again. And so that meant no work in the garden. Little jobs around the house would get put off. And then you'd feel guilty for not accomplishing things that it seemed so easy for everybody else to do. I had certainly gotten fat without thinking about it. And I thought, well, the way out is to get thin without having to think about it.
Soon after Chuck Hackett made that decision, he read something from the Mayo Clinic that suggested a way he could actually walk off his weight at work.
I dragged out the treadmill, and the first thing I do is just put my phone on top of it. And there's an old saying that I've been learning more about called way makes way. So I found a way to get my phone on top of it, and then I found a way to get my desk on top of it. And then I found out that it wasn't too hard to do to walk, I'm doing it right now, to walk 1 mile an hour or 1.5 miles an hour.
Wait a second, you're on the treadmill right now when you're talking to me?
Yeah, I've been on the treadmill the whole time.
I don't hear you out of breath at all.
Yeah, and I don't sound like I'm dead on the phone either, which is, you know, when you're on the phone and making a living over the phone, the last thing you want to do is convey negative energy.
Yeah. How fast are you walking?
Right now? 1.0 miles an hour.
And help me, that's the speed that I would walk to the corner store, or what? That's just a regular
walk?
It's much
slower than that. It's about half the speed you would walk to the bathroom from your desk now.
And is there a motor on the treadmill that keeps the belt going so you have to keep up or you'll fall off, or is it your own steps
is a motor on it. There is a motor on it. It's pretty quiet.
Yeah.
It doesn't affect my associate who works right beside me. And it just kind of goes along so that you have to keep your legs moving.
Has there ever come a time when you sort of stopped to try and make a point to a client and got rolled off the back end?
No, I haven't had that problem. I mean, at first it was a little bit, it was kind of like getting your sea legs when you get on a sailboat or something. It takes a little bit of adjustment, but not that long. So, you know, sometimes my quote screen where I give quotes to clients is right next to this desk. And so I just let myself get put off to the back, look at the quotes, and then just get back on. It's not very difficult at all. Anybody could do it.
If you're in a commodity trading business and you're living in California, you're probably starting pretty early in the day, right?
Yes, we are open for business before 5:20 a.m. our time.
And Chuck, how much time in a regular business day would you spend on the treadmill?
Well, it does vary because, you know, it's really easy to go and sit in a chair after a while. But if I really forget that I'm on it, you know, I can be on it 4 or 5 hours without thinking about it. And that's the part that really appealed to me.
And has that happened? Are there days?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been on it since I got in a little bit later this morning at about 7:30 or so, and I've pretty much been on it since then.
Now, do you do your entire working day in sweatpants? You're not in a business suit, right?
I can wear shorts because nobody comes and sees us. Most of our business is over the phone. But even if I had a suit on, you would never break a sweat. So it's not anything that builds to that level of energy expenditure.
No, just tell me what you've got then piled on your desk, and is that balanced on the treadmill, or have you actually done the sort of Home Depot thing and banged a bunch of 2x4 together?
Well, what I did was I had some office furniture that I bought a few years back. It has two legs that come down from the extremes of a desk and nothing underneath except a stabilizing vertical piece under the desk in the back. So that means that there was a room enough to slide my treadmill under it, and I just put that up against the wall, and in order to get the height, I used a couple of pieces of wood and two computer towers. So two of my computer towers are holding up the legs of my my desk.
And you can actually work on a keyboard while you're walking. I'm trying to imagine that right now.
Yeah, I could send you an email right now, and you could see that, you know, I could type a good 50 words a minute and get it to you, no problem.
Now, how long have you been doing this, Chuck?
Since about May.
And what difference has it made to your weight?
Well, when I was really fanatical about it, I actually changed my diet for a little while, and I dropped down to about 242 pounds from 285. You know, then, you know, you feel like you can afford to spend some of that hard-earned capital. So right now I'm about 253 or so, and that's eating anything I want.
Oh, so you're not tying this in with a diet. You're eating pretty well what you want, and you've still lost the better part of 30 pounds.
That's correct. That's the beauty of it for me. I mean, I probably will be adding more into the diet because, you know, once you have success in one area, it kind of spurs you on to try to do even more. And I'm feeling that desire now, but it was easy to do because I didn't have to think about it or change really too much or feel like I was making a big effort to get that first 30 pounds off.
Now, how many people are in the office with you there, Chuck?
It's just myself and my associate, Bob.
And has Bob been in any way inspired to get a treadmill or to move his desk further away?
Well, he's a pretty svelte guy to begin with, so he has been thinking about it, though.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Well, you walk, I hope. That's Chuck Hackett's trick for losing weight while he's at work. His cholesterol and blood pressure readings all changed for the better. I want to know what else had changed.
In the initial first week and a half, let's say, I would feel a lot more tired in the afternoon and was feeling it. And one thing I noticed was my appetite went through the roof. And here I was trying to lose weight, and I feel like eating everything under the sun. But later on, I found myself, usually I would have to take a nap in the afternoon from 2 to 3 or something like that. And later on, I just found myself working all the way to sundown on whatever projects or errands I had to run, where that was unheard of at my higher weight. So it was really, I really felt like I was engaged in life again as a result.
I'm sure you're doing well with the commodities trading, but I'm just wondering if you ever thought about sort of marrying the desk and a Stairmaster or a treadmill or a bicycle and marketing this, you know?
Well, there are companies that are doing this. I think they're charging between $4,000 and $10,000 for a desk specifically set up for this. I've heard different names called like things like iPlod, and I've heard other ones too.
And as far as you're concerned, 8 months after starting this, you're not thinking to yourself, well, it was a good idea, I lost 30 pounds, I'm going to get back in the Aeron chair and put my feet up. You're happy enough coming to work each morning, getting on the treadmill, picking up the phone, and just starting your day's business.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that was probably the thing that really caught my eye as based on the study from the Mayo Clinic, because the participants wanted to keep their desks after the experiment was over, and they didn't want to give them up. And that was a key thing to me, because a lot of times, you know, you can have an idea that looks good on paper, but when you put it down in real life, it doesn't quite work as well. And the fact that they wanted to keep them made sense to, you know, indicated to me that it had met that final test of actually being something that works.
So are you doing your New Year's resolution already?
Even have to make any on this score, you know. I'm just doing, basically, I didn't want to have to think about it and have to obsess about it or have to think, well, I'm doing it now or I'm not doing it now. I just wanted it to be a natural part of my life, kind of like breathing. You don't notice that you're breathing.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't that way, it would have been much more difficult. And I'm not totally without willpower, but I like to use it for other things, let's say. So if I can fool myself into doing something that's good for myself, then I figure that's the way to go.
I think it's a great idea. Chuck, I thank you for being with us on the program.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Chuck Hackett is a futures trader. He talked with me while walking on his treadmill at his office in Elderwood, California. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. While we're on the subject of weight control, it's not really like we're the first to face this issue. Gluttony was listed as a capital sin by St. Gregory in the 6th century. Warren Smith teaches historical theology at Duke University. For him, talking about gluttony isn't an academic exercise. It's something he witnessed in his own father's behavior.
When I was in college, I used to see my father come home. My father was a teacher. And late in his life, there was a particularly stressful period at school, academic politics. And he would come home and so burdened by stress that he would go to the refrigerator, open it, pull out a loaf of bread, pull out a jar of mayonnaise and a knife, and then just put the mayonnaise on the bread and begin eating. And eventually it took its toll. He had a heart attack, followed by bypass surgery, and eventually a blood clot was what killed him. But that habit, that sort of inability to deal with the stress, he dealt with simply by trying to eat. And
was he already a big man?
He was definitely overweight. I don't think anyone would classify him as being morbidly obese. But yeah, he was big for someone of my frame, you know, 5'6". Consequently, he was as self-conscious as he was about it. I mean, being someone who is in public and speaking in public, he is concerned about appearance. And therefore, when he was heavier than he wanted to be and not fitting into the clothes, you know, his suits, as he was comfortable, yeah, he was very self-conscious. And if I ever said anything to him, you know, I mean, he would be very quick to snap back and be very defensive, which would only sort of fuel the frustration.
I asked Warren Smith if, after watching his father's death, he finds himself making a moral judgment when he sees obese people.
Yeah, I mean, there's that sense of how do you, on one hand, make for yourself a moral judgment about this is what is appropriate, and then not look at other people. I mean, I think that can be natural. I think it's also helpful to be mindful that sometimes the impulse to judge arises from seeing in other people those aspects of ourselves which we're conscious of and don't like. If I see people who I think are excessive in their use, in their consumption of food, you know, sometimes the thing I don't like about them is I see where, you know, in weak moments I could go down that road if I let those habits develop. I see things that I don't like. And so the hope is that, you know, I acknowledge that I'm just as vulnerable as they are, and therefore hopefully respond with compassion rather than, you know, a censorious tone.
And if you could wind the clock back and speak again to your father, knowing what you know now, would you speak differently to him?
I hope I would. I hope I would say things in a positive way. If I had it to do over again, seeing him come in, going for the refrigerator, I hope my impulse would be to say, "Dad, let's go for a walk instead. Let's walk and talk." Because what he would really have wanted would have been, A, any gesture from me to show that I loved him, and then the time walking, because he used to be a great walker when he had been younger. He would have loved that time and that physical exercise, and that would have been far more satisfying to him than the bread with the mayonnaise.
And so if we use your example of your father and your relationship with him, what we're talking about is somehow filling the void.
Mm-hmm.
Your father comes home empty, angry. He fills the void with bread and mayonnaise.
Yeah.
What's the lesson here?
If we are, as Aristotle said, a social animal, then what we crave perhaps most is fellowship with other people who know us and genuinely care about us. If I go home and instead of watching television, spend time going out in the backyard pushing my daughter on her swing, that is more relaxing than if I just flop on the couch and pick up the remote control.
And a box of Krispy Kreme donuts.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Good to be with you.
Warren Smith teaches historical theology at Duke University. Coming up tomorrow on The Story, Tim Brooks takes us along on his hunt for lost music. See, it's always assumed that the early jazz recordings of the 20s and the 30s, that those were the first time that African-American musicians were professionally recorded. Not so, Tim discovers. Apparently, some of the very first African-American artist recordings date back to the turn of the century, some over 100 years old. Here's one, Carole Clark with Old Dog Tray, and this one was recorded in 1910. Thank you. More on Tim Brooke's search for the lost music of 100 years ago. That's tomorrow on The Story. And if you have a suggestion for something that you'd like to hear on the program, go to our website, find the Contact Me, because that's me, button on our website at thestory.org. You can send me a note that way. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.